So today we've got Gavin James. Is it Bo or Bauer?
It's Bauer.
I should have asked you that
I'm not
beforehand.
Dutch. Yeah.
I can't pronounce that.
Bowers would be worse.
Bauer, because that's got associations of
Dane.
Sorry.
My cousin Dane. Yeah.
Is that
my other cousin Lee Bowyer. Yeah. He's a
anyway,
footballer.
so we have a ri- we have a, like we have like a writer in the studio, and I'm going to call him Gavin from now on because that's the what part of his name I can say. He wrote a book called Dazed and Aroused. Which was published last year.
Yeah.
I might ask him some things about that. But are you bored of talking about it now?
No, I'm not. I suppose I'm bored of. I think I'm bored of reading it. I've done some readings and I've tried to read excerpts of it, and I find myself quite bored with the character, with being in Alex's head. And well, I suppose I'm bored of that because I'm not in his head anymore. Whereas I spent a good 2 years formulating that premise for the book, thinking about how Alex, or who would eventually become Alex, views the world, what he might do in certain situations, and then jotting all these things down. And I found a year or so after it had come out, it was quite boring thinking as Alex, or trying to think as Alex.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
Because let's get into it. Come on, you didn't like it at all.
I thought it was okay.
Okay, is alright.
You know,
what's
like,
okay
you
out
didn't
of
know what you didn't know what I did. Oh no, I can't actually rate stuff
like,
out of 10 because I'm like
okay?
Madly. Okay, let me explain it because I did that thing where you read about it before. Oh, my voice is a lot louder than yours. I did that thing where you read about a little bit about it beforehand, and like other people said things like, "Oh crap, it's described as being some sort of." Something about, you know, the meaningless of our society, or something about consumer society, and all those
yeah.
things that are really interesting.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, I can handle that. Even because, you know, obviously, if I'd read the back, I was like, ooh, models, don't
yeah.
care.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, fair play, I'll look into this. And then I suppose my expectations are slightly higher, but maybe that's mean because it's, you know, it's your debut novel. You're not meant to be a polished,
yeah.
you know.
Well, it depends what your expectations were. It's hard. It's like when you go and watch movies and you really look forward to a particular movie, but you've got to be very careful that you've not written the review in your head before you've gone and watched the movie, because when you go and watch it and it invariably isn't what you expected, it can be very, very disappointing, I think, when you come out of the cinema and the overwhelming sense is that was nothing like I expected it to be. But maybe that's fine. Maybe it isn't.
Yeah,
maybe it's just shit. I've seen shit films.
Quite a lot, yeah.
I've read shit books. So, are you one of those readers that is asking for something to be said itself? You know,
I think I either want to enjoy it,
okay,
or if it's going to be something, you know, like Lesson Zero, which I don't know if it is enjoyable, but it's kind of, it's tapping into something where
yeah.
you're like, you can, yeah. he's doing something.
It's powerful.
Yeah, that's what I
it's engaging.
Yeah. It's something, it's still engaging, even if technically what they're doing is, they're like, they're these very kind of vapid, maybe not vapid, but there's a lot of emptiness in it.
Yeah,
or,
it's a dark book though, so
yeah.
the power comes in how dark it is. But if it's not a dark book, what if it's a lighter book? How do you get the power while still getting that same sense
maybe
of alienation?
That's what I'd like. That's what I'd like you to tell us, because yours is obviously, it lacks like the violence, which isn't necessarily
yeah.
a bad thing. I think
there's no violence.
I don't think it has
except
to
for
have
the dream at the end.
Maybe. Oh yeah, I remember you sort of. I don't remember it now. It's like 2 weeks ago.
My agent at the time, who's not my agent, wanted me to edit that out.
Do they have a reason?
Yeah, they thought that it might confuse people and make them think of an American Psycho direction, seeing as we're still on Brett. And so I wanted to make sure that it... I wrote it as I'm dreaming. I never wrote it obliquely, or it was always plain that it was not.
Mm.
It wasn't happening. But that's the only time in the book where Alex really engages, and it's only in his mind. It's only when he's asleep. He actually does something about what he sees around him. It happens to be violent, but it doesn't have to be violent. And that's the way he channels it. For the rest of the book, and increasingly throughout the book, he's not doing anything about what's happening around him, what he sees, the connections he makes, because he's bright enough. It's not an accident that he spots things and reads things. He starts to try hard at things that just don't matter. But he's not, I mean, we keep talking about Bret Easton Ellis, and so it stays within the context of that conversation, which is difficult because I've had bad reviews from people who've wanted it to be like a Bret Easton Ellis book, having read that it's a bit like a Bret Easton Ellis book.
I want you to explain it to me, because I guess to me it
but
felt like...
But doesn't that take away the fun?
No, because there was no fun to begin. I'm kidding. No, no, I just want to... No, because I just want to understand, because for
it's
me
not
it
a funny
felt
book.
Like...
It's
it
not
was
a funny
kind
book.
Of...
There are
no
jokes. There are some funny moments.
It's not as dark as, say, like Ellis, and it's not as frivolous as just like someone like, hey, I used to be a model and here's some of the stuff I used to see. It's kind of...
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's in between those things, but it, I suppose it's harder to define. And so I guess I was like, well, because it's not... Because the things... For me, that he was doing weren't particularly interesting, and he wasn't that likable. I mean, so then it wasn't an enjoyable book to read necessarily.
Yeah.
But you know, there's lots of books that aren't enjoyable, but there's something in them that makes you kind of.
You read it very quickly.
Probably about 4 days.
4 days, and you weren't reading anything else at the time. It was 4 days.
Yeah, it was 4 days of.
Yeah.
I was trying
That's
to
okay.
immerse myself.
That's all right, but people have done better than that. People have said they've read it
in like
a few
all
hours.
Night.
I remember I'm working on. My first kind of attempt at writing scripts, writing for screen. So Chris had to reread it again. He wanted to reread it again. He'd read it a couple of times, and then we were doing a redraft, and he said, you know what, I'm just going to read the book again. And he read it in an afternoon in the park.
Yeah, I think that's totally possible.
Which, yeah, I think I've always liked books of that length that you could seriously sit down and not feel upset about if you've spent 2-3 hours and you get to the end.
I'm secretly, I love reading it.
Like,
yeah, like Fight Club is something I just, once I start, I just stay up until
yeah.
it's done. I mean, it is very short anyway, but it's one that you
Lessons
want to kind
in
of...
Lessons in I read that in
you
two
want to,
goes.
Yeah. But what I was going to say, it's very interesting for me then. As a screen adaptation, is how, because it's not like a plot-driven book,
no.
Like how, as a film, I think it would be even harder to make sense of.
Yeah.
Because it will just be this kind of series of events that sort of,
yeah.
you know, they're connected. And I don't know, I guess the one thing that kind of makes it, it's like, yeah, it's like his little observations or some of the things, some of the, you know, the way it's written.
Yeah.
Rather than, and so that won't come through.
Well, that's been the most difficult thing about the screenplay, because whereas I had Alex's voice as the narrator absolutely nailed, and that's the thing I'm probably most proud of about that book, I think, for better or worse, whether you like the book or not, there's no denying that there is a consistent thread throughout the book. Alex never, he's always there, you've always got him, he's in pretty much every single scene, he's doing something, no one else is important in that book, no one, and that's there from page one, and I'm quite proud of that, because that's it's a difficult thing to pull off, to have a narrative throughout a book that people get. But if they then turn around and say, oh, well, don't like Alex, or I don't like a number of things about the book, that's fine. But the narrative bit is the thing that's going to be missing from the screenplay, because how do I write that in to visual scenes without having a voiceover, without having me just saying, all right, right, well, we'll just have him narrating the whole film, which is ridiculous.
You're not going to have
not going to do
good,
that.
Good.
So then it has to be set pieces that have even less dialogue than is in the book, and everything's got to count much more than it even did in the book, which is going to be really hard. So every scene is hard work, really hard work, because there's nothing else happening.
But with that, though, I think it really would be the director as well would make a huge, like, how they do it. Because, like, have you seen, you must have the film adaptation of, say, like, American Psycho?
Yeah.
Because, like, that's, like, to me, I was like, how can you even turn that into a film? Like, because you, the essence of whatever, I don't know.
It's beautifully shot.
How would it come across?
Christian Bale is outstanding. So those two things work.
That was a really, I don't know, the first time I saw that film, I was like, that's not how I don't know, it didn't seem.
Did you read the book first?
Yeah.
So you read the book and then you went to
and
the
then
film.
I was like,
yeah.
I was just out of curiosity, I guess. But I've watched it a couple of times since. I was like, yeah, she is doing something. But I don't, yeah, it's just like, it's not a disaster. It's probably, maybe it's even a good film. But like, it's just a really.
You've got to make up your mind if you start saying things like that.
No,
it's like that. It didn't blow me away. Is that erring on the side of good?
It's hard to film, so that's why as a film it's just like
look how I get it back to me. I get it straight back to me. every time, no matter what you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
I get you back to me straight away.
Is that what we're meant to do?
I don't know. I feel like Jonathan Ross.
Do you want to keep talking about the novel, or we can move on?
Talk about whatever. Yeah. Well, I don't think we could. I don't think we really finished it, but then again,
we could go on for a long time.
Who knows?
Okay. I was going to say, what was your motivation behind writing it then? Because obviously, to write a novel is a big thing.
Stop question. Nice.
No, but motivation, that's important to me.
For me, that book isn't about models. It's not about the fashion industry. It's kind of about being in your early 20s and being in a place that you find a little bit overwhelming, struggling to connect with it, whatever. But really, the only thing I wanted to write about, as strange as it might sound, but the only thing I wanted to write about was capitalist social relations. That's the only thing I had in my head when I was setting out to plan that book, write notes, scribble about homeless people that I saw when I first came to London. That was what I was building in my head. So that's the only thing I wanted to write about. So the motivation was that I noticed and had an opinion on that, and then wanted to write something down about it. And so the fact that he's a model, or it's set there, or this happens, and that's kind of incidental. I just really wanted to write about the way we live in that very narrow sense. But when I say narrow, it's actually the thing that underpins everything. The way we relate to each other, the way we get things from each other, the way we give and we take and we exploit, or, you know.
Exactly, and that's why I wanted to read it, because I love stuff like that.
Yeah.
But
you didn't get that?
I think maybe it touches on things, but I don't think it really goes into
it. The thing is, he's not me. That's the problem. If he was me, I'd have seen a new housing estate built in the Docklands, and I'd have had to comment on the architecture and how that juxtaposed with its kind of industrial past and how the gentrification of an area, and just talk bollocks. Alex would never do that. Alex could never, ever do that. And I had to always stop myself from going down that road with him, because he wouldn't do that. He would see it, and he'd be intelligent enough to grasp it, but he wouldn't have that opinion, and he wouldn't pursue it, and he'd refuse to pursue that, no matter what he saw, no matter how much of that he saw. And he was doing it to the people in his life. So I think my motivation for writing that book is because I wanted to critique capitalist social relations. And I wanted to write an indictment of them. But the best way for me to do that at the time that I wrote it was to write about being in your early 20s and then being involved in a very ephemeral, superficial industry. And what better than the one that I'd been in? Fashion.
It's very noble. I think, I don't know, I think maybe if that's what you were trying to do, it was maybe just too subtle, I don't know. But subtle's good, so maybe, you know, the clever people, they'll pick up on it.
No, but what about this then? That I can say that, because you've asked me. But if I didn't write it that way and you didn't get it, that's me that's failed.
But that was my other question then, is who's your audience then? Because maybe I'm just not your audience.
Me. You write for yourself, don't you? First and foremost. But then it could stop like that. You could stick it in a drawer and you could leave it like that.
That's really interests me when I speak to writers, like when they are writing, are they picturing other people? Do they have an audience in their mind, or are they just doing their own thing?
I'm writing it and I'm reading it and I'm saying whether I think it's good. And it's nothing to do with what I think the market would say, or an agent would say, or a critic would say. It just doesn't matter. That's not the thing that comes to mind. That all that comes afterwards when you finished it. But it's a bit late then, isn't it? Because you've already written it.
Mm.
Whereas I wrote that, I knew what I was trying to say. But the problem with anything that you do like that, anything at all, just because you know that's what you're doing, doesn't mean that someone else does. And it's how well you've executed it. And for some people, they might read it and think, I got that totally. For other people, they might think, what a really delightful read. And I read it quickly and it was funny in places, wasn't it? And I'll go and I'll think, well, that's fine. But maybe in the back of my head, I'll think, well, what about the other stuff? What about the smart stuff that I put in there? Whatever, you know. And I've had some reviews that have nailed it the way that I've intended. And I've had some reviews that are completely off, but have still been positive. And then I've had other people say, this is a Bret Easton Ellis pastiche, or this is a really bad attempt at Bret Easton Ellis, or what's the point?
But anyway, we can move on.
I think we can.
I had other questions. I put it there. So you can take it away.
I am taking that. You know, I asked my girlfriend earlier. I said, look, I know Sam didn't really like the book. Said, well, not didn't. It didn't blow her away. Therefore, you're not going to be clinging onto it. I must keep this book, or I'll read it again, or all these things. But I was leaving that to you. Because I thought, how awful of me to turn up and say, can I have my book back?
That would have been a really terrible moment for you. I wish I'd left it now. And just
if you'd have left it for about 30 seconds, I was going to ask to take that book back. But I say that now, maybe I'm just humouring you.
I thought it'd be mean to just
give
hang
me a mark out of 10 before we move on.
I'm not allowed to give marks out of 10.
Why? What do you mean you're not allowed?
Because you do not find that hard to give them things, Mark. Because I don't see the world in that way. I actually can't do that.
It didn't blow you away. Is that more, it was okay with that inflection? Or, it was okay. Which one?
It was a mixed bag. Some bits I was like, yeah, I can see. That bit's quite promising. And other bits, I was like, that's quite disappointing.
Right.
So, you know, it's... I don't know. Let's give it six. Six.
Six. Six out of ten. I don't think you mean it, but I'll take it.
Take it while you can.
That's 3 stars on Amazon. Excellent. Don't actually go and give me a 3-star review on Amazon.
Don't
give me any star review.
Giving things stars.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's just totally move on, guys. As you can tell, it's a very contentious issue. You might want to read it. and if you find Gavin, he'll probably lend you a copy. And if you like it, you can keep it.
Don't say that.
I was going to say, yeah, so I saw you at Literary Deathmatch, which is a very interesting thing that they do. How did you get involved? Did you find them or did they find you?
A bit of both, but I found it more from a spectator point of view than I want to read at it. But I think I went to one. Evie Wilde was there. Evie's great. And who was the guy? I think he's the man who fell on Twitter. I don't know what his name is.
I know who he is.
He won in a penalty shootout. And it was a lot of fun. And then my friend Nikesh, whose book's out in October. This is a gratuitous plug, by the way, for a book called Coconut Unlimited, which is out on my birthday, the 28th of October this year, 2010, on Quartet Books, publisher of my book, where I now edit, and I edited this book. I didn't do that much work. It's great. It's really good. It was good before I edited it, by the way. So anyway.
I believe you.
Yeah, right. I just don't want to be taking all the credit. But then again, I think I keep talking.
We know that he
maybe
wrote
the more
his,
I
so.
Keep talking, the worse this will get. Yeah, no, it's really good. And he was going to read, and where did he read? He read the month before I did. Yeah. And it was a great night. Lee Rourke won that night. And I just kind of kept in touch with them all and said to Susie, she's called, I really want to read it, you know, get me on the bill. And she did. Must have been a quiet month. Are you going to tell me that I didn't blow you away, by the way? Is that what you're going
to
say to me?
Do you want me to... I could tell you about the things that the poet sitting next to me said about you, but that would be mean. I was with poets, I can't help it.
Wasn't it good? I went through to the final, did I not?
You did, but...
I'll blow my own trumpet, should I?
But, guy, how do they define... Who do they decide...
I beat the other person.
The winner is?
Well, no, I beat the other person.
Yeah.
And then we played musical chairs.
Yes, you did.
Which is a fine reflection of literary merit, hence I didn't win. Jack Underwood, the poet, won. Which is fine.
It's pretty good, though.
Fine. He was good. He always got a wider bum than me, so I think that's why I won.
Yeah, I don't think that reflected well on you. There's like, ooh, you're trying to point out physical things.
Did I say that?
You said that out loud on the stage. And I was like, Mark's against that guy.
I don't know why I keep saying it. I think I'm just blatantly jealous of him. He's really cool.
You're jealous
I like
of
him.
His arse. That much came through.
It's because he's got a full... buxom behind, and I've got nothing.
Chairs don't frighten him.
Chairs embrace him. Chairs open up for him. Or shrink. Or adapt. And
I
shift.
They
shapeshift. Move away from the nasty prose man. This is a poet's chair.
Poets are just, you know, they've got that thing, haven't they?
Why did you and your poet friend dislike me so much?
We didn't dislike you at all. It was hard to... Thing.
That is what I can't.
With poetry, there's things
that
really. With poetry, there's things.
6 out of 10 at Dos Arras, we peaked.
No,
I did not.
I thought it was perfectly adequate, but like there was just nothing you know, that sticks in your mind, isn't there? There weren't like lines or, you know, but obviously that's the thing why poetry tends to do better, because they are using their words in a different way, and it just it reflects itself better on the stage.
The problem with it is it's so a lot of the time, but not in Jack Underwood's case, and there are other exceptions, of course, but Jack was great because he read it.
Yeah, he did read it. He wasn't...
He didn't memorise it and rehearse it like a kind of quasi-rap in front of the mirror. And I always think that's really lame. Because at those nights, you have worked really hard on what you've written, but you then stand up in front of people and you read it out loud. And yeah, people might say to you, oh, well, you know, that doesn't sound that good. But you've put yourself out there to read it. If you've just memorised it, you're not really in the space. You're not there. You're not engaging with the silence, or you're not looking at people in the eye and ruffling the piece of paper and you're shaking a little bit. You've turned yourself off and you've just gone into autopilot.
I need to explain. I'll explain. That's completely... I disagree
true.
With that.
It's true, isn't
it? No, I disagree completely. What I think is true.
I'm not saying everyone who ever reads poetry...
Oh, good, because I know a lot of poetry
that I've seen is memorised, and the problem with it being memorised is you're not in the space, you're not there, you're not really performing for anyone. You could be shutting your eyes, you could be anywhere in the world, and you just blurt it out.
You've done it
a million times exactly the same way.
I think they do it differently each time,
and I think that's just
I think they're aware of the audience, and they're very, and because they're not reading, they're feeding off it.
There's a glazed look in the eye of someone who's kind of moving this and doing this, but you're looking at them and you're going to go, if you did that, they wouldn't move.
Well, I don't know. This is what I find interesting, though. It's obviously your thing on the page might have been a completely different experience for me.
That's true. When someone's reading
out loud, sometimes stuff just doesn't lend itself to that.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Maybe it was a bad choice of what I read out.
I don't know. I don't think it was bad, necessarily. I think it's just a different thing.
Your friend said it was first draft worthy. Which I can't fall back on now. So with Dazed, if someone criticises me and says, oh yeah, but you know, it's a bit like you could have done with a bit of work, I can do what you said earlier, where you said, ah, it's the first novel. You can't expect it to be polished. Second novel can't sound like a first draft, so that's not good.
But then again,
I'd have to be really, I'd have to have real problems with self-esteem if I took that and then went home and cried into the manuscript.
Another way of looking at it then, because it's like an excerpt. That was an excerpt.
Yeah, every chapter is three voices, three narrators. Yeah. That was one chapter. One
so
voice.
That it wasn't kind of like a standalone. You know, it's not like
of me. I could have written a short story. I could have turned up with a short story that I'd never performed and that I'd written specifically for the place, and I could have read that out and it would have been self-contained and people would have judged it on what it was. But that instead is about halfway into the book and it's one of the three characters and it's therefore a third of one chapter.
But I think, yeah, within context, I think it probably would have been stronger, I just think. Probably because it was isolated,
I did go through to the final, though, didn't I?
Yes, you did, that's
right.
I did. I've just thought of a really exciting thing we can talk about.
What?
Are you ready?
Yes.
What's your second novel about? Because it's got to be better than the first. I mean, it has to be, because people will think, well, you know, he's kind of...
It has to be better. I have to do better. Yeah, it has to be more... It has to be bolder. It has to be more ambitious. It has to be more refined, better executed, better realised, better everything.
I think it has to be more ambitious. I think it just has to be better written. As a, you know, to kind of make people think, yes, he's been writing for
You need
time
to have
now.
Developed as a writer. You need to have looked back first book. Has he done something different? And also, as he improved things, you do that with musicians, right? You look at their second album, you expect it to be better.
Yeah, I suppose you hope it will be.
Yeah.
So
second album syndrome. What if that happens? I mean, bear in mind it's on submission anyway, so this might be a completely pointless conversation because that might never be my second album.
That's why the conversation's actually.
It won't. It will
more
be,
interesting because it's about something.
I have to put that out there. Well, positive
this is,
vibes.
Yeah.
That James Brown song, that 12-minute absolute stomper of a song, Mind Power, have you heard it?
I have not.
You've not heard it? I've lost respect from you from the moment you said my book didn't blow you away to this moment right there.
There was never any respect, just for the record. We know that's not the case.
I don't know whether we ever had a respect-based relationship. That's fine. That's fine. James Brown, Mind Power, is the greatest song ever written. Is it? No, it's not. It's really good, though. It's a really good song. It's 12 minutes of him just really talking. At one point he says, "Give me some flute," and the guy gives him some flute. But it's really about positive vibes, positive mental attitude, PMA. Is PMA a thing? I don't know. He says it is.
But it has to
Mind
be.
That. So you put it out there. So I'm saying, oh, you know, my book, it might never be my second book. Which is true, but I have to think, no, well, I think positively. But then I second guess myself, because I think no matter what James Brown says in that song, do I really believe that just because I sit here saying things out loud that are positive about my book, that that somehow translates into energy and vibes that will find their way across town to a commissioning editor's head, who will then say, "Made in Britain, yeah, wow, I've got to sign this book up." I don't think I do.
I don't think it works that way, unless we were to bribe someone.
So how does it work? I think it works. Like, if you're positive about something like being on submission, even if the very real chance that it is rejected happens, if that actually comes about, you'll be fine with it. You'll bounce back somehow, or you'll apply yourself some other way, or maybe you'll go and sell it 6 months later, or maybe you'll adapt it as a screenplay and it'll become Good Will Hunting but set in the north. That's a blurb for Made in Britain.
Do you remember how I went really quiet then when you said it?
Like, everyone went quiet. Everyone listening went quiet. I've preemptively silenced the room, stunned the room.
When's it going to happen? We need this.
Good Will Hunting. Right. Ooh. It's really not like Good Will Hunting, but maybe I'll write the script and star in the film like those guys did.
They managed to sort of get away with it.
They got away with it. It's a brilliant film, right?
I quite liked it.
Ben Affleck's bit at the end, though, now, when I watched it recently, the bit where he says, "If I turn up at your house, you know, and you're not there," that's an awful scene.
They're laying it on quite thick. But, I mean, you know, yeah, it's a film for a wide audience.
Yeah, but Matt Damon and Robin Williams are really good in the scenes where they lay it on. I don't know, maybe they're just better actors. Or maybe I'm being unfair to Ben Affleck because now I'm expecting a big thing from his scene, having remembered it. And when I watch it, it's not quite as powerful as it was when I first saw it. And therefore I think, oh, he's not that good an actor. Maybe it's all on me. Maybe we're having this conversation again about what you bring to the table when you watch something or read something. And what's funny is I'd seen that film already with a different set of expectations, which had been met or not met or whatever. Years later, I watched it again with another set of expectations.
But you're a different person.
That's true, but the art form's not changed, has it?
Anyway, back to what were we talking
about? You
asked
me what the second book...
Were we talking about you? Yes,
we were definitely talking about me. The second book syndrome, and what is it about? It's called Made in Britain. Should I do the three sentence what it's about thing, or should I do something more original?
More original. Where do you think you are?
I finished the book a long time ago, Made in Britain, and it's become something else, I think, since I wrote it, because it's been edited and really worked on, and now it's finally on submission. And it was always meant to just be a book about home, a book about growing up where I grew up, which is in the north, but really it's not about the north as it as a geographical place. It's more like just provincial Britain, just not London, you know, small town anywhere. It could be anywhere in London. No, it could be anywhere in Britain. And it's really about three kids growing up somewhere where they don't fit in, and what that feels like, and how it's different for everyone, and how some of them have grand aspirations, and some of those aspirations are, you know, blatantly ridiculous and never going to be realised, and how some of them are destined to stay where they are, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. It's not, unlike the first book, which I think is an indictment of the way we live, Made in Britain's not an indictment of the place or small town Britain or the North in any way. I mean, it's kind of a love-hate story in a way. I've said that before, that is a bit of a stock quote, but it is true. That is definitely why I wrote it, because I have a love-hate relationship with where I'm from, which a place which I grew up wanting to leave, desperately wanted to leave, and now I'm very precious about it. I'm very happy when I return there, and don't want to live there, but do really, really have good things to say about it and the people there. So it's a, that's a mixed bag of an attitude towards a place, and it's many Britons an attempt to reconcile that.
I come from somewhere that I would argue is worse than the North.
Where, like, do you come from?
From the Midlands, which is like this... No,
the Midlands isn't...
The no man's land of nothingness.
Right.
So there's no identity to it.
You don't really get the accent
thing. So there's like... There's nothing... Yeah, there's like...
You're missed out in the North-South divide. The whole
debate.
That's what
I mean.
You're not even involved.
It's like we're just like this black hole of this, you know... And it's awful because you grow up wanting to escape.
Yeah.
Desperately. But, you know, and then you visit and you would never actually want to live there again. But it's kind of... There's a weird... Yeah, that mixture when you go back. It's like... This weird nostalgia because your childhood happened there and all sorts, and it's just, and you can see it changing, and it's really interesting. And you know, it's like the countryside, you get to see trees again.
You know it more intimately than at our age, anyway. I mean, this may change, obviously. If I stay in London for the rest of my life, then fine, I'll know London very well. But that place, for some reason, and not just in a street by street sense or a, what houses look like or what was there, but you have a really, truly intimate knowledge of that place.
Yeah, definitely.
And you cannot replicate that feeling anywhere else. I don't feel like that about London. I love London, but I don't feel that intimacy with the place and the people. And it's not just because it's London, it's the same with a place like Manchester that I spend a lot of time in, or I went to uni in Sheffield, I'm fond of Sheffield. But I haven't got that intimacy, that feeling, that sense that I get when I go back to Burnley.
I think you can only get that if, you know, early years.
Yeah, you've grown up there in your, you know, rudimentary state.
But yeah, like you say, it's a really mixed thing when you go back to these places, because you feel protective of it in a weird way, even though you hate it in a weird way.
Yeah, or have hated it, and now you don't really know how
you
feel about it. They're all like that. The three characters in the book are, we kind of hate it, but we obviously belong here in a way. We're of this place, we can't deny that. We speak like this, we speak a certain way, our attitude and our sense of, you know, right and wrong is formed in this place, and so we can't deny it in that sense. We absolutely can't deny that we belong there, and yet we have this overwhelming urge to leave it or be something else. Or, you know, Hayley wants to be a pop star. She doesn't really want to be a pop star. She just wants to be on a stage and looked at or talked about, or just something which is not what she is at school. She's not one of the popular kids. She's not one of the really pretty kids. She doesn't get to go out with Charlie. Charlie is popular kid, but he just, you know, just does not fit there. He's too smart for the people he hangs around with, but he's probably not smart enough to go anywhere further than where he is, which is ending up selling drugs, you know. And he sells drugs not because, you know, that's all he can do, but that's just that kind of lazy decision that he makes through the book, through a bit of immaturity and a bit of naivety, where he gets in with these people who he thinks are a better fit than these lads, these kind of hoodlums that he hung around with at the beginning, and he would have been better hanging around with them. But anyway, that's naivety. Hayley's naive, and Russell is also naive, but they're 16. He thinks he's, you know, going to be a Thomas Chatterton. He thinks he's going to move to Paris and write a novel and hang around in a, you know, a silk set of pyjamas and just be really arty and interesting, and everyone will want to know what he thinks. And he actually just writes a lot of bad poetry. He's probably going to go to uni, think he's got, you know, the handle on the world and know what he's, you know how everything works, and he doesn't know anything. So they're all naive and they're all a bit silly, but they're all sweet, I think. And I don't know, I like the characters, so I'm hoping the book gets picked up sooner rather than later.
Like, what do you bring to that sort of story or those sort of themes that another writer might not?
With Made in Britain, I've written about where I've grown up, which countless writers have done. So really, I've not done anything original in that sense. I've written about growing up in a place. Now I live in a big city in the south, and I've written about what it felt like to grow up in the north. But actually, the thing I bring to it is that sense that of trying to articulate what it feels like to have a love-hate relationship with where you're born. And I don't own that feeling. I'm not unique, but I've tried to write it down. And so I hope that the very fact that it's not an original premise is its power, is its, you know, its real strength, because people will take to it and say, that really, you know, chimes with me. Or they'll think, that didn't come across on the page, Gavin, you didn't achieve it, try harder next time, if you've not given up writing at that point.
No, I think that's good though, because I don't think there's any issue with it should be completely original, or you know, because basically people are just retelling the same stories over and over, and they tell them in different ways.
Time immemorial.
Yeah, and I don't know.
I said time immemorial. I did actually just say that.
Yeah, but I kind of talked over it, so maybe they didn't know.
Maybe no one said it, even though I repeated it. Yeah, who knows?
It's better that way. But yeah, no, I think I always read loads of things, and often there's certain things, you know, you are reading the same, in inverted commas, the same thing, but it's not the same thing, and so that's
you
not
try and, you try and have an original voice, or you try and, well, do you? I don't know. Maybe you're just telling a story. There's nothing original about that. You're just, you know, describing the world.
Here's my other stock question. Then, if you, yeah, when it comes to telling stories and writing, is it something you enjoy, or is it more like a compulsion where, you know...
I don't even think of myself as a storyteller. I mean, the first book's not really even got a plot. It's an idea. I was going to say it's ideas driven, but really it's idea, singular, driven. And it's not really about plot, and so it's not really a story, is it? It's more of a statement, a premise. Whereas Made in Britain is plot driven, and it's got these three overlapping narratives and stories. And all the three stories really just stand alone. You could separate them out. And I did that at the editing process, and I found that really strange, reading Hayley chapter after chapter after chapter. Storytelling, therefore, isn't the kind of thing that I start with, I don't think. So to say whether I enjoy it or not maybe misses the point. Do I enjoy writing?
Yeah, I was just trying to think to write. That was my
question. Is that fair? Just writing, whatever I'm trying to do, even if it's just a, you know, writing a bad poem or something like that. Do I enjoy it? I think so, because I find it comes very natural, and you tend to enjoy things that don't feel like hard work. I think if it was graft, if it was really, really arduous, I don't think I'd do it. But I do agree with you, kind of touched on it, saying, is it a compulsion, you know? Yeah, I think so. I think if you write and do things like that, you do feel compelled to do it. You have to do it. Not in some kind of, I have to, you know, I've got a mission. But you of course you're going to do it. You type it out, you scribble it down, but you don't have to share it with people. I don't think that's a compulsion. I think that's where the ego comes into play. Because you could just write it down and say, brilliant, that's a nice story. I'll stick that in my drawer and I'll read it later.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's why it's always interesting. Like, yeah, the whole thing's interesting when people obviously like performing poetry or, you know.
Yeah.
But obviously you want people, because as an audience member, I often enjoy listening, or, you know, as a reader, I enjoy reading, so I want them to do it.
Yeah.
It's all good by me.
Yeah.
But it's I don't know, I do think people write for different reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and it's different, and there's obviously some people do see it as graft, but they see it as like necessary graft. So like the initial idea phase where it's kind of fun, or that bit, because, you know, then actually turning into something.
The graft comes later. The graft comes when someone starts telling you what they think about it. And then you have to go,
But that, I think that's
a
good
draft.
It's, I don't know, it's good to listen to other people, but
absolutely.
Obviously you've got, but everyone's going to see it differently, and so you've got to kind of also in your head have that really.
You've got to edit you've got to edit who you're going to let edit your book. You've got to pick the voices and the opinions and the feedback carefully before you then send it out to be judged by everyone.
But I think the trick would be, not that I know anything about, so this is just me being completely preposterous. I said it wrong. It's like I'd want to have feedback and listen to other people, but I'd want to have still a very clear idea in my own head is what I wanted it to be, because obviously other people might shape it and distort it, and I completely by the end of it I'll forget what I was trying to do to begin
with.
There's
a danger of that. The ending of Made in Britain is not the original ending, and it was a conversation with one person that led to that changing, but other people had picked up on it and mentioned it, and when I then talked about changing it and did change it, several people then said, oh yeah, I think you should have done that. So not that means it was the right thing to do, but in my opinion, I wrote an ending that satisfied me, but that didn't work. Worked for me because I liked the idea of what I'd tried to pull off, but it didn't match what I'd written, and I needed someone to say, look, you got there 90% of the way, but what have you done at the end there?
Mm.
It doesn't fit.
Yeah,
it challenged
yeah.
me to say it fits, make it fit, or change it. So I changed it, because that's the easiest thing to do, isn't it? Less work.
I wouldn't know.
Just left the rest of the plot intact and just, yeah. No, I didn't. I had to work on it really hard. And I don't believe I've written as three, narrators. And if people say it's an awful book, it'll be for who knows, a number of reasons. But part of me will think if people don't like it, I tried something that was too hard in terms of three narrators. But I'm proud of that. I think it was a good thing to do. I think it was really fucking hard, and I'm never going to write as three narrators ever again. Back to one narrator, first person.
By and by, if anyone's still listening, which of course you are, I'm sure you've noticed that I kind of indiscreetly cut huge chunks out and kind of paste them back together in a not very skillful manner, but, you know, go with it. So, there's now a bit now where I've decided to cut out about 10 or 20 minutes worth of, you know, stuff that's really interesting, but, you know, it's not really about it's not really about the book or about Gavin, so it's gone. So we're going to launch straight back into another bit, which probably would have sounded totally random if I hadn't warned you, so bring it on.
This has been a train wreck of an interview from start to finish. And I've lost it, you know.
But
and
you
I'm
going
to start saying now, every time you ask me a question, I'm going to say, it is what it is.
But you know what, we could just delete it, because I read, like, moments before you arrived, that you did an interview the other day with some Cambridge people that, you know, it's the same stuff I would have asked you. What's it called? It came out, it was published on the 8th of September, which is today.
I did an interview?
Oh, God, do you not know about this? Let's Google you right now.
Oh, my God, are we now going to read live a bad review?
No, it's not a review, it's an interview.
Who with? You're Googling me. That's familiar.
I read it just before, and I was like, crap, there you go, I don't need to ask him any questions. Oh, January? It was in January. For some reason, I read it as being published today.
You read an interview that was published in January?
Yeah, but I was confused. It does say January. For some reason, I thought it came out really recently, and I was like, oh, God, I'm just at the end of a series of interviews. But anyway...
Christiana Spens.
Yeah, all the stuff that we didn't cover here, people can read there. And that's very nice and neutral, because it's just like a transcript.
Yeah, she is. that was a good interview.
Yeah, because that's how I learned things. Like, for example, you were trying to write a literary novel. Not just a novel, literary novel.
I'm shuddering. You don't think it's literary? Of course it's literary. It's style over substance.
Well, yeah, I don't know what literary is, but there you go. That was my, there's my thing. What makes something literary?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not here to
idea.
Answer that question.
No,
it's like a weird thing.
Christiana, she's definitely a literary writer, because she's a really wonderful writer. She writes... Have you read The Wrecking Ball? It's really good, really good. So it was a pleasure that she did an interview, and she was really nice. Still follows me on Twitter, I think. I don't know whether I've DM'd her. I should DM her to check.
Don't do it. Anyway.
You can't DM people who don't follow you. That'll come back. Oh, Christiana Spens unfollowed. If Christiana Spens unfollowed me, I would give up writing.
Could you not just, like, kill yourself instead? Because then
on that
the
note,
rest of us would be saved.
Are we
going
to go to the death threat that I got after Literary Deathmatch, or are we...
Did you really get one? Why would you do that? Why would you get one?
Was it you?
No, a death
was
threat.
Was it you?
No, I didn't do that. I consciously try not to be mean to people. That's why I was like... I'm
you
not...
do not!
No, that's why...
No, we've worked this out. You consciously try to be mean.
For the record, everybody,
which
the reason...
you mean.
During my email correspondence with Gavin, I said... I might not do the review because I don't want it to sound mean, because I wasn't obviously loving the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fine though. That was nice. That was pretty nice.
To wrap it up, because it says an hour and 35 minutes.
Oh my God. You must... I'm onto you. You must like me a little bit, because we've been talking for an hour and a half.
Yeah,
you'd
fine.
Have got me out of the room in half an hour if you didn't like me.
Very, very hard. It's very hard for me to get rid of people. But
there
course,
were opportunities
yeah,
to wrap this up.
It's fine.
Were there?
My wrapping up thing was going to be like, yes, okay, we earlier, before I think I switched the mic on, we were having like worst film ever and stuff like that. Or maybe that was when the mic was on, don't remember. So, okay, back to literature. Best book ever, novel ever. You've got like...
Best book ever or best novel ever?
Novel.
My favourite novel is Last and Zero.
That's a really boring answer because we already knew that.
Yeah, but I've said that.
But why that one more?
Did you do any research?
A little bit. Do you know what? I've got a day job, yeah, and I've got a magazine I'm supposed
I've
to be
got
editing.
A day job. I work in publishing. And Twitter a lot. But my favourite novel is Lesson Zero. Shall I answer the
other
question?
Other favourite.
Favourite novel not by Bret Easton Ellis?
Yes.
Because my second wouldn't be a Bret Easton Ellis book, to be honest, so... My next favourite book. I've got to say books that I've read recently. I don't know why. Books that really stick in my mind. I think anything by Polanyuk should be on there because I just think he's a master. You know, I read a book called The Ask by Sam Lipside recently. Brilliant book. Brilliant book. But what he does in it, he riffs. And he's there are some really good set pieces that he works up. And he's brilliant, but nobody does that better than Chuck Palahniuk. And he's prolific. He does it over and over again, does it in every novel. And Sam Lipside, you know, admittedly, he said, I interviewed him and he said, you know, God, this is my third book. Chuck Palahniuk's so prolific, he's brilliant. And so, recently, Sam Lipside, The Ask, The Canal by Lee Roark, brilliant books. They're recent books that I've read that I love. But anything by Chuck Palahniuk would be on my list. Fight Club. Boring. So boring. So boring. But yeah.
We're going to start talking now because
we're bored of each other. We can't stand each other.
It's been a
really
because
I'm desperate to unfollow you and I'm itching to grab my phone.
Do you want
to
log in right now?
I don't want to do it in front of you. No, I don't.
Look, if you're going to do this, let's do it honestly. Let's do it in front
you
of me.
You told me to my face. To be fair, it's not
because
like
I'm honest.
I'm
respectful.
Yeah. Like, I think you should now re-follow me, but I promise to tweet less.
Oh my God.
And if you don't like it and you want to unfollow me again, you can, of course. But I think you should I think you should give me another chance. If you're not going to give my book another chance, which I don't think you should, bin it, forget it. I'm taking it home anyway. You have to give me another chance on Twitter.
I will take up your challenge.
Excellent.
We've achieved something today.
You definitely achieved something. I've gone warm and fuzzy.
And I'm supposed to say thank you very much for coming in and talking to
me. Thank you for
me.
Having me.
It's been a delight.
It's been a delight.
So yes, thank you very much to Gavin James Bauer for coming in and sort of taking the abuse with remarkable grace. I'm sure you'll agree. And for anyone who's very, very concerned, he didn't have to walk out carrying his own book because one of my flatmates came back and he gave it to them and it was a happy ending in a non sort of pornographic way. And yes, next week we've got two poets coming in, going back to poets where it's safe, and they're going to be amazing. So it's all pretty good, pretty exciting. So keep watching, however you keep in touch with these things, you know, keep on it, it's all good.